Okay, what we want to get into this morning, right off the bat here, is the subject of leadership or how to lead. Leadership as defined. Oh, by the way, I've got this on a handout, so you can, Bob, you want to do this? Yeah, there should be one per. Most of this information that I'll give to you, it's in the notes. I tried to make the notes rather detailed so that you wouldn't have to spend that much time writing, but you could. I'd appreciate it if you'd not thumb through or try to get ahead, because you tend to lose the concentration on the thought that we're discussing. But I did try to make the notes explicit enough so that you don't have to do a lot of writing, and you can concentrate on trying to understand the concept or the point we're trying to make. Leadership in Webster's dictionary is defined as the ability to lead. Now that's very significant, because if you look at the word ability, you'll understand that leadership is not talking about position, but it's talking about your performance. It is an ability. It is something you're doing. And so a leader, one who is leading, like one of the books I read, D.E. Host, I think it was, from the China Inland Mission, made the statement one time that a leader is someone who's got followers. And so that's very true. But a leader is one not based on his position, but based on his performance. It's what he is doing. It is his ability to lead. So if you look up the infinitive to lead, then in Webster's dictionary, what that says is to show the way, to conduct, to guide, to direct the course of another by going before or along with. And that's what Webster says about the verb to lead. To lead. Now, if you'll try to dig out that the meaning of that explanation, you'll come up with two things out of that. See, if a person, first of all, a man has got to know where he is going. He has got to know where he's going. How can a person be a guide? How can a person be conduct someone else if he doesn't know where he's going? My brother does a lot of hunting. He's gone down into Mexico, and he's gone up into the Rockies and several places like this to do hunting. And when he goes to a strange place, they always hire a guide. And they always do very well on their hunts. My brother's an excellent hunter. He's a good shot, et cetera, et cetera. But without that guide, he would really be in poor shape. And the guide takes them and shows them the way to go, because he knows the terrain. He knows where he is going, and he knows where the hunting areas are. And so my brother is very successful on these hunts, but it's the guide that's really the key, one who knows where he is going. Another thing that's contained within that definition is the fact that he can persuade other people to go with him. What good is it to be someone who knows the way if nobody's going? And what difference does it make if you know exactly where you're going in life if you cannot persuade anybody else to go with you? So I think leadership can be reduced to two concepts: a man who knows where he's going, and a man who can persuade other people to go with him. Now, this guy who knows where he's going, we'll spend a session each on these concepts, a session on the guy, on how to become a man who knows where he's going, and a session on how to persuade other people to go with you. But the guy who knows where he's going is a person who is deeply infected, and I love this word infected, but he is a person who is deeply infected with a cause, with an idea, or with a vision. He is possessed, he is obsessed almost by this vision that he has, by this cause, by this idea, by this thing that he wants to do. I remember I had a summer training program one time in Boulder, Colorado, among a bunch of hippies up there. And one night I was walking along the streets up there, and I was just spending some time in prayer. It was real hot, and I was just praying about the situation, and I began to think about Dawson Trotman. How was it that Dawson Trotman was able to affect people? I remember a pastor down in Tucson, Arizona one day, a friend of mine was chatting with him, and this guy said, you know, I knew Dawson Trotman, and he said, I got 15 minutes with him one day. He said, that's the only time I've ever met him. I spent 15 minutes one day, and he said, that 15 minutes changed the course of my life. Can you believe that? You met one man, 15 minutes, one time, and it changed the course of your life. And that was that pastor's testimony of his time with Dawson Trotman. And as I thought about Dawson Trotman walking around in Boulder that night, the thing that came to my mind was the fact that he knew where he was going in life. He had a vision, and he was doggedly, tenaciously hanging on to that vision. And this is what he was going to do. You know, whether men went with him or whether they didn't, or whether men rallied around him or not, this is where he was going. And I think that's one of the reasons that Dawson Trotman was so attractive to people, was because he definitely, without a shadow of doubt, knew exactly what he wanted to do. He was out to train men. He was out to raise up godly disciples and then see them spread throughout the world to raise up yet others. I think at this point we could say it's hopeless for you to think that you would ever be a leader until you are deeply infected with a cause. It could be a wrong cause. It can be totally erroneous. But if you are deeply infected with it, you'll lead some people. And we see that in fascism and Nazism and some of the other things, communism even. You can see it doesn't matter what the cause is, but if you're deeply infected, then you are a leader and people follow you. Let's think about having clear-cut objectives. Boy, gang, if you can't spell it out in detail, I would hesitate to say that you're a man who knows where you're going. And in fact, you can evaluate yourself. I can walk up to you and say, now listen, I want to evaluate whether or not you're a leader. Answer these two questions. Where are you going? What do you want? What are your objectives? And you can say, well, there's quite a few things I'm going after. There's quite a few things I want. But gang, I would almost say without an exception that unless you can spell it out and spit it out to me without hesitation exactly where you're going in life, I doubt if you would qualify as a leader. And then this other thing is a man who can persuade another person to go with him. A motivator. A man who can establish relationships. I remember reading, and I think it was in Dedication to Leadership by Douglas Hyde. I think it was in that one where he said that what most movements need, what most new movements need is a leader and gathered around him a body of able lieutenants. Boy, I really like that concept. Here's a guy, and he has around him a few men, just a few men, but who are able lieutenants. And boy, they almost inevitably they make a fantastic impact. A man who knows where he's going and who is accompanied by a small band of able lieutenants. I think a classic example of these two concepts married together, or married here, would be in 1 Thess 2:8. Where Paul says, for we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were dear unto us. 1 Thess 2:8. His objective was the gospel of God, imparting the gospel of God to these people, getting the gospel out, to telling these people about Jesus Christ and how they could be delivered from darkness unto light and from the power of Satan unto God. That was his objective. And he was governed by it. His whole life was given to that. But on the other hand, he was also very much of a person-oriented. He was very much of a relator. Because he says, we were willing to have imparted unto you not the gospel only. That's it. We are working on that. But that's not the only thing. What we're really after also is giving you our own souls. Because you're very dear to me. You as a person. And for leadership, these two concepts have got to be married. They've got to be married. I think of the navigators, the guy that... and I don't want to pick out people because I know so few navigators. Well enough to make a statement like this, but the person to me that personifies this more than anybody else is the regional director under whom I serve at this time. His name is Dwight Hill. Boy, you're talking about a guy who knows where he's going, who has his objectives clearly stated, and man, he is going full steam. But at the same time, he is a very warm, loving, accepting, motivating. I get around the guy and I dump, you know, all my problems and everything, and the guy encourages me and he helps me. A tremendous insight, but I'm tremendously motivated by the guy. He is a people person, but he's also a very objective person. And he's one of the few men, and I say it's few, but he's one of the few men that these concepts are, both of them, are very beautiful and very obvious in his life, both of them. Now, I know a lot of people who are very objective-oriented, but they can't relate to people. They know where they're going. They seem to know exactly where they ought to go, but they just can't persuade anybody to go with them. And then I know some people who are tremendously motivators. Man, they'll stand up on the stage and they'll give a talk, and man, then people will get all excited, but nothing ever happens because the guy doesn't know where he's going next. And he's a tremendous motivator. Man, he's got charisma, and he's got zeal and enthusiasm, and he looks good, and he's sharp, and he's got some illustrations, and man, the crowd gets turned on. But when you get around the guy and say, okay, man, I'm hot, let's go do it, and he doesn't know what go do it is. And it's pathetic. And I've seen several, particularly among the youth leaders, who had tremendous charisma and had tremendous high school groups or junior high groups or college groups or whatever it might be. But it was destined to die because the man was he went on the basis of his charisma and his enthusiasm and not on the basis of a guy who had a clear vision and clear-cut objectives. And it was destined to die. Well, let's get into this thing about how to become a man who knows where he is going. And by the way, I might mention that what we're going to talk about here is not a product as much as a process. In other words, when you start talking about how to become, then you're talking about a process. You know, one of my favorite verses, I think, is probably Mark 1:17, where Jesus says, Come you after me, and I will make you. I will make you to become fishers of men. And what he invited them to do was to come and become a part of a process of maturing. It was a process. Mark 1:17, come you after me, I'll make you. I will take you, and I might break you, I might reshape you, I might remold you, but I will make you into a man who is a fisher of men. And he did that. I've got a section in my verse box I put all my verses, I took them out of a biblical order, you know, Genesis to Revelation, I took them out of that order and topicized them. I put them all under topics. And one of the topics is I went through my verses one by one. It took me a week to do this, but I did the past sermon. I took a week out of the sermon. I just did this. And as I went through my box, verse by verse, one of the topics that kept recurring was the topic of God's training program. And some of the verses, you know, like Psalm 34:19, many are the afflictions of the righteous. What? The righteous? Many are the afflictions of the righteous. But the Lord delivered him out of them all. That's just God's training program. That's just the way he does it. Oh, pain. In the leadership books that I've read, one thing that is consistently brought out in every leadership book that I've ever read is that a leader suffers intensely. It's just part of it. It is a process, gang, and I think that's one of the reasons why few men become real men of God and real leaders. As I think because they are simply not willing to pay that high of a price. And oh, is it high. On June the 1st, I became an area director, whatever that means. I got more area now, okay? I have more geography. Instead of having one campus, now I've got about 12 or something. We don't have people on all those campuses. We only have people on about 4 of them. But instead of one, now I've got about 12. And I had to come up with a 3-year plan, you know? Okay, where will we be in 3 years? And I want to know where you'll be as far as people, where you'll be as far as geography, and how much money will it cost you to get there. Oh, I had to sit down and come up with that stuff, you know. Well, anyway, I have had more criticism and more people taking pot shots at me and chipping away with me with little comments since I have become responsible for this area than I had the other 2 or 3 years put together. And gang, it has been phenomenal to me. But the higher you get in an organization, the better shot you are. For instance, the guy that really makes his mark is the guy who can criticize Billy Graham and make it stick. Right? Man, if you can knock off Big Billy, then man, you have really made a mark. I note something, Billy. Da 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 da. And you big headlines in all the, you know, the evangelical newsletters and the magazines. The higher you go, the more criticism you'll pick up. It is inevitable because you're just a much more luscious, juicy target sitting up there. And boy, they will snipe at you. But it is a process, and if you will stick with the Lord God and learn to live with the criticism and learn to live with the tension and learn to live with all the things that you have to go through, then God would use you in a mighty way. And again, the reason there are so few godly men is because the requirements are so stringent in the eyes of God. I think in this book, Spiritual Leadership by J. Oswald Sanders, he makes the point that the reason is that there are so few leaders, is that so few of them can pay the price, and that God will not allow a man to lead publicly until he has surrendered privately. Oh, that was fantastic. In other words, the guy has dealt with God in the closet, and then God has the freedom to use him on the platform because he's dealt with him in the closet. The guy has surrendered, and he's yielded to God, and then God can use him publicly. So if you can do that. It's a process. Now, one other thing I'd like to talk to you about before we get into this thing about how to know where you're going, before we start talking about goals, then I want to present the concept to you that the goals are covered under your priorities. In other words, before you can begin to set goals, you've got to establish your priorities. And I would like to, if we can show it on the overhead, I don't know if this will come across or not, but what I've done is I just tried to... What I've tried to do is I just duplicated the priorities that I operated under this last year. Now, the first thing that I put down under my priorities and objectives, can you see that very well at all, by the way? But anyway, the first thing I wrote down was my relationship with God. To me, that was number one priority. And I put that down as my relationship to God was number one on the priority list. And underneath that, I listed some objectives. And I listed them under two categories, the Word of God and my time in prayer. And I listed some very definite, measurable objectives underneath my category, underneath my priority. Now, for instance, under the word, read through the complete Bible by 31 December 73. I try to read through the Bible once a year, just my reading program. Complete the design for discipleship study every week, including in that study a turning objective for the chapter and discovery, understanding, and application questions on every section, because I would be leading a lot of those studies. And I wanted to have questions, discovery questions, understanding questions, application questions written out on every section, because generally you lead that study section by section. And as I did my Bible study, I wanted to do that. Memorize key passages, do a methodical Bible study. By the way, that's a pretty good book out on Bible study. Methodical Bible study by Traina, T-R-I, train with an A on it. But it's kind of how to do chapter analysis. It's a kind of a detailed book, but it's pretty good if you can wade through it. Review my verse box this quarter. You know, I kind of like to get through my verses this quarter. And in my time in prayer, I had that listed, so much prayer a day. Then the next thing was my relationship with my family. And then the first thing was regarding Robbie, my wife. Help Robbie fix the house, the garage, and the yard to her liking. I found out in my marriage that was a little more important to her than it was to me. So I put that down as one of the things I wanted to do as far as Robbie is help her fix the house in accordance to her liking. So we got this couch that's got a hole in it. And she's kind of been that thing kind of eats on her emotionally, and so we got the thing upholstered, reupholstered. And establish some prayer times with Robbie. That's usually I can do that on Sunday afternoons and Tuesdays. Tuesdays is kind of a family day. But that's something I had to work on. I had to write that down. Isn't that something? You got to write down to get prayer with your wife? Arrange for Robbie to get a day alone about twice a month or so. That usually worked out about once a month. But we have a little cabin on the beach there in San Luis. Actually, it's in Morro Bay. And a fella owns it and lets us use it. And we go, and Robbie goes out there and spends the night by herself in this beautiful little cabin right on the beach, and takes her jogging gear and a couple of books or so and her Bible and some notebooks and stuff like that. She goes out and spends the whole day with the Lord and spends the night and comes back in sometime the next day. And I try to get that time for Robbie. She really needs that just to get alone by herself, because she's got some objectives she needs to evaluate and this type of thing. Arrange for Robbie to have the car. She needs it. I travel quite a bit, and when I leave, there goes the car. And I try to always, either one of the girls or one of the guys brings their car over and leaves it at our house. And she's always got a car, always. Regarding the children, we got an old box out back that it's an old shipping crate, and I kind of made that thing into a playhouse, you know, took a saw and cut some windows and cut a door out and hinged it back. And then we went out there one day and slapped some paint on it. It looks horrible, you know, because the kids painted. They're a little playhouse. Well, I'd kind of like to get an old piece of carpet and throw it in there, you know, and put some pictures on the wall, cut them out of magazine, you know, and stuff like that. But work on the playhouse. Well, I got this stuff with the kids, you know, and I've got things down here. I have 3 dates with each child, you know, per quarter. I like to take each of our kids and just go out on a date with them. We'll go out and get a hamburger or something and just go out and we'll sit and talk for about an hour, you know, have a good time. And I'll ask them about school and ask them about their friends and who they like to play with. And I always ask them this question now. You know, Amy or Jennifer or Jeffrey or whatever, you know, I'd really like to be the best daddy I could be. Can you think of anything that you'd really like me to be doing that I'm not doing with you now? And inevitably, yeah, stop spanking us, you know, something like that. I kind of need to write that down. You know, one thing we put down is purchase Christmas gifts by 31 October. One of them, all out of the way. And we did that this year. Why don't you scoot that up a little bit, Bob, would you? The third priority I have down here is my personal health, because if I don't feel good, then I just really blow everything. And so I had that down. And one thing I wrote down... one thing I wrote down was that run at least 3 times a week. I find if I don't run, I don't necessarily get fat because I'm so intense that I just burn up the, you know, my metabolic rate is so high, I just really burn up the food. But I'll get lethargic. I get kind of apathetic. I just sluggish. And so I have to run to keep the respiratory and the circulatory system kind of functioning. I was lifting weights for quite a while there, and I kind of hit what I was shooting for, and so and the schedule really got tight, so I dropped off that. And sleep 7 hours a night, minimum. But I put that down on my health because I want to maintain a healthy countenance. When I walk out on the campus and get time with a guy, I don't want to say, "Hey, tell me about how's it going? Yeah, how's it going?" I look like I just came off of a downer or something, you know. Hollow eyes and emaciated, you know. I don't think the guy says, "Boy, can I be on your team?" You know, he's just not really dying to be on my team. I look like I just came out of a POW compound or something, you know. And at the same time, you know, I don't want to pamper myself. One of the things I've observed over the years here is why a few men finish well. I wrote up a little sermon on that. If we had time, I might slip that in here, but I don't think we'll get to it. But why a few men finish well. And one of the reasons is men begin to take it easy on themselves. And so I don't want to take it easy on myself. I think, you know, Paul over it, you know, where he said, "But I buffet my body and make it serve me, lest while heralding to others, I myself should become a castaway." I think it's 1 Corinthians 9. Is that 24 or 27? 27, somewhere there. My ministry objectives that I have down here is a fourth thing, and that's a complete one turning objective for each dorm leader. And lead a man to Christ every quarter, and start and lead a design for discipleship study with 4 men. Recruit 3 men to the NAV vision. We had a big conference at Disneyland, and I wanted two people myself that I administered to would go to that. And I wrote down my ministry objective: read 12 books this year, read a news weekly, learn 20 new words vocabulary wise. And I learned that from Leroy. Leroy is always trying to increase his vocabulary, and so I try to pick up a few words here and there. You know, when you come out of I came out of a kind of a rural high school situation, and vocabulary was not my thing. And I had a vocabulary, but it wasn't acceptable. And then I went over to Texas A&M. Things didn't really improve too much over there. But I came into the ministry with a very poor vocabulary, and so I've tried to work on that over the years. And I wrote down a word last night I heard a guy use, and I'll just whip out my little success diary and open it up, and I'll write that word down. And I keep a section in my notebook on new words, and I'll just write them down, and I'll try to learn them. When I read a book, I circle all the words I don't fully understand. I'll just circle them, and then I'll go back through that book and pick them out and plug them in, you know, and try to learn those words. Activities. My objectives in my activities. You always place your activities underneath your objectives, because your activities should help you accomplish your objective. But you know, you'll meet man to man with these guys, and I'm teaching a Sunday school class and witness 3 times, and you know, blah blah blah. And then kick it on up a little more, would you, Bob? Then underneath that, I listed number 5, projects. Some certain projects I like to get done. I like to completely redo my verse box, start a design for discipleship notebook to include my study, my training objectives, and all that stuff. So I've all got it in one notebook. I do a study on leadership. I did that a little bit. Make up my prayer verse cards and learn to play one song on the harmonica. I thought I'd learn how to play harmonica. You know, I almost got down Michael Rowe, the Boat Ashore, and I bailed out, you know. So that's the only project that I didn't get complete, but I never quite mastered that harmonica. Tough instrument, yeah. Okay, won't you? But see, what we're talking about is you've got to bathe your objectives underneath your priorities. Now, let me say one other thing right here. I got some time with a guy on campus here not too long ago, and this guy, he wasn't making too good of grades. And so I went to him, and he was a little bit behind in his studies and losing a little sleep and this type of thing. And I went to him. I said, "Well, Dave, how you doing?" "Well, okay. How's everything going?" "Well, pretty good." And I asked him, "Could I see a list of your priorities, please?" And by the way, gang, when I meet man-to-man with people, one of the things that we try to do is at least every other time or at least once a month is we break out, okay, let me see your personal priorities and your personal objectives. Let's take a look at them. And so a man breaks out his objectives, and we just go down through them one by one. And this is a guy that these are the things the guy said before God, "This is what I believe you want me to do." Now, if you're not doing these, why aren't you doing these? And this helps us tremendously in our man-to-man times and in our evaluation sessions. Oh, gang, if the guy's going to write them, use them. Make them meaningful and significant. And we do that. Well, I asked him to break them out, and I said, "Let's take a look at your priorities here." So he listed them off, and they were all neat, you know, God and family or whatever, and you know, and then there was his health, and then there was his studies, and then, you know, all ministries after all that. See, he had them down beautifully. So I said, "Well, okay, Dave, what time did you get up this morning?" 5:30. Okay. Okay, good. By the way, what time did you go to bed last night? 12:30. Okay, 12:30. 5:30. What all did you do this morning? What was your first class? 8:00. Okay, 8:00. What did you do from 5:30 to 8:00? "Well, I studied for an hour, and I got an hour with the Lord, and blah, blah, blah." And I said, it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we went down through that hour by hour, and I listed everything that he'd been doing that day. And then I said, "Okay, Dave, let's see, how much time have you spent? How much time did you, was your quiet time this morning?" And I think it was 30 minutes or 20 minutes, because he had a, you know, he's kind of tight and behind on some things. And so, okay, time with God today, 20 minutes. Okay, how much time have you spent in ministry? Well, he had met with a couple of guys, and there's that. And how much time have you spent studying? Well, about 2 hours studying that day. And he had some classes. And I asked him, okay, what did you have for breakfast this morning? I think it was a bowl of cereal. Something like that. What did you have for lunch? Well, I just had a banana and something. Okay. And so I wrote all that down, and then I drew it out, and I summarized it. God, you know, I wrote down the priorities right across the top, and I wrote down the number of hours spent. And I said, "Now, you, Dave, would you please, in God's name, tell me how you're living according to your priorities?" Because the thing that he was giving his time to was his ministry, and he was behind in his studies. His sleep was suffering. His personal health was suffering. His time with God was weak. And I said, "Dave, for God's sake, tell me, what are you doing with your life?" Because, gang, any day of the week, I should be able to, now there are some exceptions to that, but almost any day of the week, I should be able to come along and say, "Tell me what you have done today, hour by hour," and it should reflect the priorities that you've written down. And if it doesn't, you're fooling yourself. You're deceiving yourself. And of the things in the Scripture that I see that wash a man out more than anything else, it's this thing of self-deception. Be not deceived. You will pay for what you've done. For God is not mocked. For whatsoever man sows, that will he reap. And you sit there and tell me, and you have these nice, neat little priorities and these nice, neat little objectives, but the only thing wrong is that you don't live that way. And gang, you are destined to suffer for that. Question?
Okay, I've got two questions. One, you mentioned it seemed like you were saying that your daily schedule ought to reflect what your priorities were.
Yes.
Okay, I suppose you've got a schedule set where on Monday night you're going to spend 4 hours with me. But on Tuesday you don't do anything like that. Well, Monday, when you evaluated it that way, then your number one priority would have been your ministry. And then on Tuesday, you said you didn't go out with him. Then you said, "Well, you don't have ministry on there at all." And my question kind of ends with that. Does time spent on a priority, is that equal to the priority that that thing holds? For example, if you spend 7 hours sleeping and don't spend 7 hours with God, then you say
Yeah. Well, I think you've basically answered them, you know, just by the way you've asked your questions there. You cannot isolate a day as such. You know, there are extenuating circumstances that justify the situation. You say, "No, well, today you did this." But I can say, "Well, today I didn't get any time with my family." But see, on Tuesday I spend several hours with my family. The morning is with my wife, and the afternoon is with the kids, and generally that evening we go do something together. So I can say that my priority as far as getting time with my family is in balance. because I have done that. I do know where I'm going, and I have plotted that. Now, so well, what this concept that I'm speaking of is a consistency, a pattern. I'm trying to deal with a pattern. And in this guy's life, the illustration I gave, this was not an exception to him. It had become pattern. And that's why I dealt with him so severely. And by the way, I went on and told that guy that if any other time I come back out and his schedule and priorities are all fouled up, he's off the team. Because I will not be the cause of a man failing in life. I will not allow him to turn to me and say, now, well, it was that ministry that did it. No, it wasn't. I will not allow a man to fail and blame the ministry or to blame me. It's him. He did it. And I want him to know that. So I would tell him that that I would relieve him from the team if that happened anymore. I would not be responsible for his mistakes like that. But anyway, then the other thing, as far as the number of hours, you're right. See, the number of hours that I spend with my children does not equal the number of hours I spend with my wife. My children have a very short attention span, and we'll spend 15 minutes together of quality time, and it's highly satisfied them. They've really enjoyed it. But if I spend 15 minutes with my wife, that's good, but generally she needs more time than that. But by the way you ask your questions, I think you've got it pretty much scoped out. But I'm trying to deal with a pattern in this concept. Okay, should we hit number one? I don't have any idea what time it is. Let's hit a couple of them here. The first way to know how to become a man who knows where he's going is to develop deep personal convictions. Yang, a man will die because of his convictions. And let me clarify here that when I say convictions, I'm not talking about a set of beliefs. I'm not talking about the Apostles' Creed. I'm not talking about, I believe, blah, 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 or the Pledge of Allegiance, or whatever it may be. I'm not talking about a set of beliefs. I'm talking about my personal bedrock convictions that before God, this is what I believe is right. And there's two ways that I have down here that you can work on that, and that is by consistent personal Bible study, and I like the verse-by-verse meditation type of Bible study, where you go through the Scriptures and meditate verse-by-verse-by-verse and come up with your convictions before God as the way you ought to live your life and the things that you ought to be doing. And then the second thing is by the consistent time for meditation and the quiet time. To me, should be the time where this is so rich. I remember I heard a tape by Stephen Olford on the quiet time, one of the most fantastic tapes I'd ever heard on the subject. And what he said was to go read a certain section of Scripture, a very small section of Scripture, and just meditate on that Scripture. Read through it two or three times. And the third time you read through it, personalize it and read it for yourself. And read it and try to get application out of that for yourself and let God speak to you out of that. Well, I begin to do that. And on some passages of Scripture, I would have to read the thing for 3 hours before I got anything out of it. And I read, I would read it for about, I remember in John 17, or some section in there, I got up and would spend an hour reading it. And I'd read it over and over and over and over. And I'd read it for an hour. The next morning I'd come back, God had not dealt with me out of that, and I'd read it again, over and over. And in some Scriptures, it'd be 3 mornings in a row in that same little 15 or 20 verses of Scripture before God would say, that's what I'm trying to get across to you right there. And gang, some of the bedrock convictions, some of the basic things that govern my life right now, the convictions that govern my life came out of those times of meditation with the Lord. And I'd highly recommend it, boy gang, that meditation be one of the things that just characterizes the way you spend your day. A verse on this that's really been helpful to me is in Hebrews 11 says, by faith Moses, when he was born, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hid for 3 months by his parents. For they believed, for they saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now that's 11:23. Now see, that's Moses' parents' faith. That's their conviction. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid for 3 months by his parents. Now the next verse says, by faith Moses, when he was grown, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. In verse 23, it's Moses' parents' conviction. In verse 24, it is Moses' conviction. By faith, Moses refused to be called. And gang, somehow, you have got to become a man who operates by conviction. And let me say parenthetically here that if you are training men, one of the things that you have got to train men in is to become men who function on the basis of convictions. You've got to help men to establish their own convictions. Remember, we'll hit the second one quickly here, and that is by the maintenance of a rigorous personal schedule. And of course, in the light of your objectives. Your schedule should reflect your priorities and your objectives. One of the things that we try to do out in San Luis Obispo is to plan the next day before we go to bed. You go to bed and you think, okay, now what am I going to do tomorrow? Now, I like to try to do this before I leave my office. I got 8 billion things I can be doing. And so I think, what do I need to get done tomorrow? And I generally like to think in three categories. You don't have to write this down, but just to stimulate your thinking. I think, what is it that I must get done tomorrow? Man, if I don't get this done, the war's over. Okay, the second thing is, what do I need to get done? I don't have to get it done, but I need to get on this and get this done. And the third thing is, what would I like to get done? I mean, if the rapture comes and I don't have this done, it won't matter. But I'd kind of like to get this done. And I think, and then the fourth thing I think is, who can I delegate some of this stuff to? I love that one. And I think one of my strengths, if I can say this, that one of my strengths is delegation. And one of the things that helps us as far as a team is that these people don't work for me, they work with me. And they are doing so much of my work, and we're so involved in this whole thing together that we're all like a big family. Everybody's doing everything, you know, type of thing. And I delegate so much, but I really believe that it's one of my strengths, the ability to delegate. Man, the first time I get something to do, I think, well, who can do this? And I really shovel it out. Again, the fact is that you are on a schedule. You do spend 24 hours each day. Do you realize that? You do spend that. You are on a schedule. What I'm trying to propose to you is that you get on one that's worthwhile. And gang, that will take agony. Now, the girl mentioned last night, you know, that something about her, she never, you know, been brought up to learn how to spend money. Oh, could I identify with that one? Ever since I was in junior high, I have never been able to complete studies like I wanted to get them done. I can remember back to junior high, the teacher saying, now listen, this is what the test is going to be about, this is what the course is going to cover. And I'd say, man, I'm going to get this thing studied, and I'm going to walk in that class, and I'm going to lay it all out. And you know, when the test time would come, and guess what, the night before I'm up just starting on it, I'm cramming like crazy and everything else, trying to bail myself out. And gang, that has been the story of my life, a lack of discipline, poor use of time, ever since I can remember having things to do and trying to get them done. And so, gang, it has been agony, agony, agony as I have had to make myself write out a do list, make myself schedule my day. But, gang, I heard Lawrence Sanders say one time, and I believe it, that he has met some tremendous men who are disciplined. I mean, some tremendous men who are gifted, well-qualified, fantastic minds, tremendous charisma, a tremendous amount going for them, and complete failures in life because they had never learned to discipline their time. And I heard Dr. Howard Hendricks say just about exactly the same thing on the tape. Failures in life because they had failed to learn to discipline their time. And so I don't want to be a failure in life. And so I work on this rigorously to try to get a schedule. I'll cover this with you in ministry mentality, but I got a little sign that I made up. And I had one of the guys, you know, put it on a plaque and, you know, put some rosin on it. And I got it hanging in my office right now. You know what it says? It says, a man, I made this up, so take it for its worth. It says, a man will never know how much he can do until he enthusiastically attempts more than he can possibly get done. I just love it. But I push myself and I drive myself because I want to learn to be a man who can do more than he ever thought he could. One of the ministry mentalities that we operate under is that capacity is simply a state of mind. Beginning what I'm talking about, though, is this thing of get yourself in a rigorous personal schedule. You're going to become a man who knows where he is going in life. You can't slop through and reach any objective that men are attracted to. Small plans do not inflame the minds of men. And you cannot slop along, dilly-dally through life and expect to turn around and see men following you. You'll see a lot of them on the sidelines laughing, but nobody will follow you. And we're talking about becoming a man who knows where he is going. Speaking of going, it's time for lunch. And I've gone through the things myself, you know. I've gone through the same arguments and everything as Max.
Doug, I think where this is helpful, like you said, the guy thinks that when he is gone, they can reach 12 guys. And then at the end of the first semester, they have three. The thing that helps him to evaluate is when you've also found out that on a normal basis, in order to reach three guys, you may have, you know, on average, talk to, you know, 15 in order to get one.
Yeah.
It helps him from the standpoint of seeing what he's actually doing to reach guys. I mean, and that's one of the big Yeah. I mean, Jack is up to see if he's on target. I mean, maybe the guy's problem is he's not witness.
Yeah, like in that was our problem in one of our dorms. Things, they didn't have very many people in evangelistic Bible studies. And so the leader got with his guys and said, what's the deal here? How are we doing? And of course, he had Bible studies too. And they tried to, and they finally came up with the fact. One guy said he just didn't believe in the concept of evangelistic Bible studies. He didn't like the concept. And so they asked him, what are you doing? And it turns out that the reason he didn't like the concept is because he just didn't like the witness. But just by sitting down and using this figure and then saying, now what? Here's where we are. When you evaluate, what you've done is you've looked at where you are in respect to where you said you would be, and you analyze the variance. That's evaluation. And so you take this thing and you say, now gang, this is where we said we'd be, and here's where we are. Now what happened? And it's always good to do this before, you know, you've the quarter's over or the year's over. A little late then. Just a tool.
What kind of resources do these dorm leaders have like that?
Resources like, you mean men?
Yes.
Oh, I think he started off with about 4 or 5 guys. Old David's gunner, though, they led 12 guys to Christ the first quarter. So he kind of got after it over there. Let's see, where's Muir Hall converts? They said he'd have 8 converts, didn't he? Yeah, 8, and he had 12 the first quarter. This is year-long objectives, by the way.
Did he do that same thing?
Oh, no. Oh, you should have seen, you know, he did everything on earth. Had movies and popcorn feeds and, you know, all kinds of surveys. And man, he just really went at it first quarter. We sat down and came up with the categories. And then each man got with his gang and came up with the numbers. But we sat down and came up with the categories. See, I didn't want to say, okay, now gang, everybody go out and set your ministry objectives. So one guy comes in, he's got 6 things, and the next guy comes in, he's got 8, but this guy's 6, so not like his 8. And so just for the cohesiveness of the group, we established what categories we wanted to set objectives, and then let each guy get with his team and go set the numbers, type of thing. Wayne?
How do you tell when young Christians been recruited? How do you measure?
How does the dorm leader measure? Oh, I'd say 2 things. One is, 3 things. One is heart. Secondly, his response to you. I think that's probably the biggest one, his response to you as a dorm leader. And then the third thing, I really kind of hate to throw this out, but I think it's true. I think we do use it, and that is his participation in the activities. Does he come to the activities? And that's, I'll list that one third because I don't like it, but I think we do look at that. And in the final analysis, I'm afraid it's a gut level feeling. Either you can tell if a guy's just really with you in heart, or if he's kind of lagging behind, or he's just, you know, some guys you meet with them every week. Sorry about that. You meet with them every week, but still you sense they're holding you at a distance. You ever met with a guy like that? And you can just sense the guy's kind of keeping you in back a little bit, you know, and you kind of prowse around a little bit and prowl around and probe a little bit here and there, and you can sense that the guy's kind of, you know, he's fencing with you, you know, he's keeping you back. So although a guy may be involved with us, if he's that way, I wouldn't say he's really recruited to the gang. He's not a part of our vision. We recruit to the vision. That's the main thing we go for.
In your
Yes. Yeah, this year, Dave Yaden, when Dave Yaden went to Yosemite, he was the only guy that we even knew of in Yosemite dorm. 690 people, I think, down or something like that, or 590. I think it's 590. Right at 600 people in that dorm, and he was the only guy we had. He went down there by himself.
So that'd be more of a personal goal rather than, you know,
for
myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wasn't anybody to set him with it, but him. Yeah. One thing that we did as far as these dorm leaders here this year is we told these guys to listen now. You get with your guys and you set your objectives, but then what I want you to do is I'm going to be looking to you for the strategy. And then I asked the guys, I said, listen, what I'd really like to know is, what are you going to do the first 2 weeks of school? That's what I really want to know. And so this guy would say, okay, now what we're going to do is, school starts on Monday. The Sunday night before, we're going to go through and have a popcorn feed and pizza. We're going to have pizza and popcorn and a pop down in the dorm lounge and invite everybody. And we're going to eat and have a good time. And we're going to hand out a little flyer that we printed up on the fact that there's a Bible study in this guy's room on this subject, and there's one in this guy's room on this subject. And he says, no, we're going to do that this night. And then two nights later, we're going to go around and hand out a survey to everybody in the dorm. And then over the next 2 weeks, we're going to go by and knock on the door and ask for that survey. Did you fill it out, and can I have it, and rap with the guy about that? But what I want to know is, what are you going to do to get off the launching pad? And that's always tremendously helpful for the guy to write down on paper what he's going to do to get off the pad. Because you'll say, now listen, Dave, you're responsible for this dorm, right? Right. Now, you're responsible for the evangelism, right? Right. Okay, now, Dave, you'll have to do the evangelism. Okay, okay. And so the first thing he does, he thinks, okay, now let's see, what am I going to do? And I better pray. Yeah. So he walks around the dorm and prays. And then, I got to get my guys. I better teach my guys how to do evangelism. We'll have a seminar on how to present the bridge or something, the RPM or whatever, I don't mean to make, I'm just joking with you, It's a good track. But anyway, you get with your guys, and so 3 weeks have gone by, and the guy has not even witnessed to the first guy yet because he's getting ready. So what I do, just help the guy get off the pad. I say, okay, now tell me what you're going to do the first 2 weeks of school. I want to know. Before school starts. And so he works, and then he comes up and says, well, we're going to have a seminar. I say, when are you going to start witnessing? Well, listen, Dave, the quarter is 32% gone, and you haven't even started. And when are you going to fly your flag? And I want you to think through on that again. And so we work on that some, see? That didn't happen this year. Generally, the guys came up with so many ideas, they couldn't do it all. Man, they had that thing swinging. But that's tremendously helpful for them. See, Dave Yaden down in Yosemite, he said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going into Tower 3. That's where I live. And I'm going to start a Bible study on my floor in Tower 3. Okay. Four guys. Next thing I'm going to do is the second quarter, I'm going to start a Bible study over in Tower 5. And I'm going to select one of those guys in my Bible study on Tower 3 and take him with me to be my assistant. Okay, good deal. Okay. Third quarter, I'm going to start a Bible study in Tower 7. And this guy, and I'm going to lead it for the first week. And then I'm going to bow out, and this guy that's leading my Bible study in Tower, that was my assistant in Tower 5, will now take that Bible study. I will be leading the Bible study with four guys in Tower 3, four guys in Tower 5. He will be leading the Bible study with four guys in Tower 7. That was his strategy. At the end of the year, I would like to have 12 guys who are consistently studying the Bible. I'd like to have 8 of those guys memorizing Scripture, blah, 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 blah. Well, see, that was tremendously helpful to that guy to sit down and think through and pray over that and wrestle over that and walk around the dorm and think and then write all that down and say, with God being my helper, this is the way I'm going. That was so helpful to him. I'd recommend you do that. Come up with your objectives and then come up with your strategy. How am I going about this? Jim Downing told me one time, he said, I can't say this positively, but he said, God seldom ever gives a man an objective without giving him the strategy. In other words, here's what I want you to do, and here's how to go about it. God reveals both to a guy. And so I would encourage you to not only select your objectives, but to work out a strategy. Yay.
You engineers so much under the area of social, physical, mental, spiritual.
Uh-huh.
Give a little bit of help here on how a guy develops the syllabus.
Let's take physical or something like that. So one thing the guy wants to do is in a physical area, as far as a syllabus, as far as really helping the guy in this hour, in this area, is sports, and let's put tennis. Let's say that the guy, he just kind of dinks around, but he kind of likes tennis. And so one thing he could do as far as the syllabus is he could work with this guy on developing and helping him develop his tennis game. Now, under this, he might have down a read a book, and it's easy to get a book. All you got to do is call the tennis coach and say, Coach, this is Chuck Madden. I just live here in town, but I felt you were a guy who could really help me. I'm just looking for a book that really illustrates the basic grip and the swing and the basic fundamentals of tennis. Could you recommend one? Sure, there's the Kramer's book on blah, blah, And so then you go to this guy and you say, listen, have you ever read this book? And he says, no. And you say, well, man, That's not a bad book. I checked that thing out of the library the other day and read through it and practiced a little bit, and that thing has really helped me. But see, what you're trying to do is, if the guy has an interest in tennis, you just lead that. You help him develop that. And what he reads from that, I believe, usually it's what he'll read from that, is you're not just interested in his little spiritual compartment. You're interested in the guy's life. Because you would take the time to read a book yourself and work on it, and then he goes out and kind of works on it, and both of you guys get better. And that'd be an example, just a little syllabus. And you can come up with all kinds of stuff like that. It helps. If you do select a sport, it helps if both of you are very interested in it. You know, because you don't want to say, okay, well, why don't we go and run out and play tennis, you know, and, you know, you couldn't hit a ball with a, you know, three rackets in each hand, you know. Would you have a question?
What are you trying to do in a way physical and health?
Well, the basics, of course, is that the thing that I really like is his countenance. How does he look? And that's the kind of thing, if the guy looks like he's a walking ghost, you know, anemic and emaciated or whatever, you know, then I just try to help him with that. I think it's a good idea sometimes for guys to get a tan. I remember Leroy used to be, Leroy's a fanatic. There's no way, he's just a fanatic. This guy would go out and snow all over the earth out there in Colorado Springs. He'd go out there and sweep off his back porch, you know, get the snow off and put a chair down out there. He'd have some, you know, he has so many clothes on he could hardly move. You know. He walks out in his backyard, but he sits down. One year, he's this guy's a nut. One year, he took I hope he never hears this say. One time, he took a piece of cardboard or tin or something, and he bent it in a big U shape, and then covered it with tinfoil. And then he would go out and he'd put that thing behind his head, and lay back in the chair, and the sun would hit this thing, and just all over his face and neck and everything. I mean, it's just like living under a heat lamp. And it'd be colder than a mother-in-law's kiss outside. And he'd just, you know, heat this thing up, you know. But the reason he did that was because he knew that when he spoke to a bunch of men on a base or a campus, and he was tanned, that he looked more of a man, and he would come across as a man. This is something for men, you know. And guys would respond to that more, and so he did. You know. I think the thing that we need to concentrate on is the fact that we are doing some thinking about every area of this guy's life. And we're concerned about every area of his life. And if he ever picks that up, I really feel he'll be one motivated individual. I think he'll really be turned on. Wayne?
Chuck, how do you go about helping a guy with an area of his life that he's not ready for help on? He's not open for it. He has sort of a need. You know, or something you can say
there. I think generally, Wayne, unless it's critical, I don't worry about it. Unless it's really critical. Let me say two things. Then one, that's the first thing. Unless it's critical, don't, you know, you don't have to worry about it too much. The other thing is that a man, sometimes the reason a man doesn't deal with something is because in reality he just can't see it. It's a blind spot to him, and I know this has been true in my own life. A guy came to me one time and said, "You know, Chuck, I feel like you're really hard on yourself and you're really hard on your men. Be careful about being hard on your wife, though." Well, see, that was a warning to me. But I said, you know. A guy told me one time, he said, "Boy, Chuck, you're really hard. And you're hard on your men, and you're hard on yourself, and this type of thing." And internally, I thought, well, you know, you cookie pusher, you know, a bunch of jello eaters, you know. Why don't you suck it up and get with it, you know. You're just. But see, what God was trying to do is he's trying to speak to me about an area that I just could not see it. Well, eventually, Gene Ward shared a verse with me one time, just, you know, one of those crunchers. But I just memorized it coming up here the other day. It was Job 33:14, and it says that God speaks in different ways. If not heard in one way, then he chooses another. Boy, I reviewed that verse coming up here and worked on that thing, and it just scared the life out of me. Because what that means is that God oftentimes will be trying to get your attention on something, and you're completely oblivious of it. And so what he has to do, it's kind of crank up the frequency a little bit, change directions, and come at you from some other angle. Boy, that one. After a while, if he doesn't get you there, he just kind of cranks up the frequency, comes out, and eventually he'll get your attention. But God speaks in different ways. If not heard in one way, then he chooses another. Job 33:14 in the Berkeley, I think it is. Well, anyway, that's what happened to me. There's some things that I dealt with several times after guys had really tried to point it out to me, and I just didn't see it. It wasn't that I wasn't teachable, but in fact, I could not see what he was talking about. And so this is one reason I really feel like it helps when you correct a man, to correct him on the basis of patterns. You have seen this thing exemplify itself here and here and here and here. You've seen that. And so therefore, when you point out the flaw or the weakness that he has in his life here, then you can give him about a half a dozen illustrations of it. And this really helps him to see it more often than not. And generally speaking, when a guy sees it like you see it, he'll deal with it. It'll just kill him. He can't believe he's been that ignorant. And I've seen that happen time after time after time with many guys. Is that where they've got something in their life, and you can see it very plainly. And you kind of share this with him, and you kind of share that with him. And then one day you just kind of share a pattern and how it come out this way and it come out this way, and this guy said this, and this came out, and this was a situation. And you share about a half a dozen or four or five examples of how it showed itself loud and clear. And I have seen guys weep over their lives when they see it like that. And I just kind of picture that it's like God taking a big picture window, I mean a big mirror, and just going right in front of the guy, and he says, "I can't believe it." And he just dies. But for the first time, he has seen what other people have seen for quite a while. And when that happens, well, I have seen guys repent with tears and everything else because of that. But just, so I think one thing is that I would try to, I would think in my mind, does he see it the way I see it? Can he really see it? I wonder if a guy can really see it like that. Chances are he can't. So I'd work on, you know, that. And on the other hand, I think sometimes it's just not that critical at this point. At this point, I really can't think of any vivid illustrations of a situation where a guy had a fault, but it wasn't critical. Usually those are nickel dime. Small things, you know.
You think the things that you've been sharing here along these lines, are these applicable to both for a guy or a girl at any level of experience, both whether it's, you know, Christian, you know, 3 or 4 days, a week old, or one that's further along, you know, one guy that you're really meeting?
The concept that, you know, the level I've been shooting at is leadership.
And this is what I'm...
Yeah.
Thanks.
Some of the things, of course, like loving a guy communicating to a guy that you really believe in him, these things are true throughout. But so many of these concepts are, I'm trying to equip leaders.
That's what I was trying to get in my mind. That's what I was thinking. Yeah, I just want to
make sure. Yeah. Just a second, Carolyn.
You were talking about looking at Sam's heart, sermon, about trying to think when he changed his guy. I don't quite see what all you look for. I'm wondering if one of the things you look for is just how he's feeding, like God's word, especially in a truth where he's.
Well, that sounds like some type of a contradiction. The guy, if I'm looking at the guy and working with him, and I sense a real responsiveness to God. And then here's an area in his life that's going to really wipe him out down the road, and he won't respond to it. Then somebody I had a girl one time like that. So I guess it's, you know, it can be a reality. But there's a girl that take it out of my check, will you? Goodness, this is poor Mike. Anyway, I had this girl, she had about two or three things that I felt would really eat her lunch down the road. I felt it would put her on a shelf. And I shared them with her in a context. I try to be very gentle and very complimentary during our time. I took a long time to do it and this type of thing. But there's a couple of things that she just would not. I mean, she really would just kind of bow her neck and not deal with that. And so I eventually, I had two thoughts. One is I can just live with it and let her go, continue as she is. And or two is I can deal with it. And I went out to a motel one weekend, and I sat down. By the way, I recommend this to you. If you ever got a problem, just take out a piece of paper and write down everything you can think about. And I went out to a motel that weekend. I got me an old yellow tablet, just something like this. And I sat down, spent a lot of time in the Word, and I prayed some, took some long walks. Then I came back, and I took out a piece of paper, and I began to write down everything I think about this situation. I just wrote out the history of it, as it first began to develop, how it had exemplified itself, how I'd seen it, et cetera, et cetera. I just wrote the whole thing out. And then I prayed about the situation, I thought about it, and then I determined that I would deal with it versus trying to live with it. And so not too long after that, I went and shared some of these things with her, and I didn't get much response. Not too long after that, one of her flaws was is that she didn't have a job. And as a result, the three girls that lived with her in the apartment were having to carry her as far as financially. And I'd spoken to her about the diligence with which he hunted for a job. And see, my basic philosophy on that, if you're looking for a job, if you're looking for a 40-hour-a-week job, you should spend 40 hours a week looking for a job. And if you're looking for a part-time job, 20 hours a week or so, you ought to spend 20 hours a week looking for a part-time job. If you're not working, you ought to be spending the time you would be working looking. That's very logical to me, and makes very good sense. And I know how draining it is to look for a job. I've looked at for them for weeks when I was with the NABs and had to go someplace and get a job. And I know how draining it is. But the fact is, she doesn't have a job, and other people are having to carry her, and she's trying to minister to these girls and help these girls, and she herself being a very poor testimony. Well, I was doing a Bible study in Timothy, I think it's 1 Timothy, where it talks about the ones that don't work don't eat. And I thought about that, and I wrote down, I sat down in that cafe, I was working on my Bible study in the cafe, love to do that, love to get time with God in the cafes. And I said, I'm really a freaky guy, there, but yeah. I was doing this Bible study in the cafe about 2 o'clock in the morning, a little behind. So I'm working on these things, and I work, and all of a sudden I come across that verse. And this girl and the whole problem just comes to mind. And so I think, well, and I just sit there and wrote down what I'm going to share with this girl in light of this passage. And I did. I went to her and I said, well, and I opened up the scripture, and I said, now, we've talked about 2 or 3 things, and this is one of them. Let me share this with you. These are things I've asked you to do, and these are the reasons I've asked you to do these things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Had it all written out. And I said, I am starting, this was on a weekend, Saturday or something like that. I said, starting Monday, if you fail to look for a job 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, then you are removed from all responsibility with the Navigators in San Luis Obispo. And I said, what I want you to do is write down the time you walk in the store, the time you leave the store name, and what job you applied for. And at the end of that day, I want the time added up. And at the end of that week, I want the time added up. And if it doesn't add up to 40 hours a week, then you're relieved of all responsibilities at San Luis Obispo. She was flaming mad. But I would not stand for her to commit suicide right there in front of my eyes. And so I chose to deal with it versus living with it. Now, to me, it has a very, I think it has a good ending. She went to another campus the next year, and she was supposed to go on, she was supposed to kind of, she was in the same position I was. We were both contact points. You know, this was both our first year assignment, and so we were equals in a sense, except I was responsible. And so that next year, we were both supposed to go on, you know, kind of an area rep staff. I'm called an area rep, she calls the girls worker, navigator terminology, meaningless. Well, so I got with Helene and some other people, and I shared this with her, and I did not believe that she was ready to go on staff. And they agreed, and she was not placed on staff, held back for a year. Well, I think that the girl, as a result of all that, dealt with it during that summer, and the following year was a different person. And I've heard tremendous things about her ministry and her heart, her cooperation with the guy she's under now, and all this type of thing, and it really seems that God has dealt with that. But see, I told her, shared with her, tried to do it in a loving way. I, you know, You know, I am not the most loving guy. I just like to walk up to a guy and say, listen, you meathead, this is the way it is, you know. You know, why waste words? But see, but I'm trying to be loving. I'm trying to communicate to these people that I care deeply for them. And so with this girl, I tried to work on that with her. But I had to share with her, I said, if you do not deal with these things, I can almost guarantee you that within 3 to 5 years, you will have eliminated yourself as a servant and a minister of God. I can see it down the road. There are 3 areas. And that was one of them. But I think she's dealt with that. I really think she has. Those are tremendously emotionally draining times. The whole week, just wipes you out. But if it's a critical area, and you see that it's going to really hurt the guy, then you really need to get your act together, think it through, find out the root problems, how they exemplify themselves, search the scripture, what are the scriptural principles that are being violated, and then you got to make a decision. Am I going to live with it? Or am I going to deal with it? And it is painful all the way around. And see, the thing about it is that some of the leadership thought that I was demanding too much and criticized me and jumped on me all over me about that. And see, it's not a thing where you go in and you do something and all the guys come up to you and says, boy, good job, man. You're really a builder. I can see how you really have a man hanging there, buddy. We need more men like you. They come in and cut your heart out. And you just have to say, well, before God, I believe I did the right thing. And it is so painful, you want to quit. Mentally, you write out your resignation 150 times. Mentally, you tell everybody to go bite the dust. But all you can do is just sit there and eat it. The criticism, et cetera, et cetera. You know they're going to go back to their big RD and their DD meetings and all this kind of things back at headquarters, and your name is going to come up, and you're going to get this reputation, or this is going to be said, et cetera, et cetera. You just live with it. That's all you do. You know, because I don't know how many times that verse about, I would seek unto God, and to God I would commit my cause, which doeth great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. I don't know how many times I've taken a walk and said, God, I'm going to let it rest with you. God, help me not to get bitter, mad, upset. God, help me to let it rest with you. I would seek unto God, and to God I commit my cause. God, I'll leave it with you. And that's about all you can do. Every book I've read on leadership communicates that same concept, that leadership is extremely costly. I was talking to Dwight Hill the other day, and on the phone, and he called me about 3 mistakes I'd made. I was sent to Woodlake Ranch and said, listen, get over and get that bag of worms squared away. And so I went over and I started getting that bag of worms squared away. And then he called me and he says, listen, you're spending money you don't have, and the guys at headquarters are climbing the walls. And he says, I won't tell you what they told me, but he said, buddy, you're in trouble now. You've got to stop that. You've got to somehow, change that. You've got to sell some of that stuff you bought, and here I'm in trouble. All I'm doing is trying to square the place away. But you just have to kind of figure out what God wants you to do and do it. And I can tell you something. I hate this going to tape, but I can tell you something. In a leadership position, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And if you can live with that, then you can be a leader. When we were in Vietnam, you'd go in the village, man, you'd fight, and you'd go in there and you'd lay down a blanket of fire because you'd protect your men, and some woman would get hurt or some villager would get shot in the arm or something or hurt, and man, you've never seen the static that would come out of divisional headquarters because, what are you doing shooting up this village, you idiot, you? And so, the next village, you come to, okay, let's hear what we'll do, gang. And so you kind of, and one of your men gets shot up. And so they're, what do you mean? Why would you protect the fire? What are you concerned about your men? And you get eat out for that. And what do you do? You say, well, you don't say before God, you say, well, I felt I was doing the right thing concerning, in considering the situation and the circumstances, I felt I did the right thing. And you sit there and take your lunch. But every book I've read says that that's probably the price that most guys fail at. As I just, Dwight told me on the phone, he said, listen, Chuck, if you don't have a cast iron gut, then you're going to have to get out of this. He said, because criticism, he said, Chuck, I love what you're doing. He said, Chuck, I would take you over 10 men. He said, I love what you're doing. I love you on the team. But Chuck, get used to it. You're going to be criticized heavily, whatever you do. And he said, if you don't have a cast iron gut, he said, you probably ought to get out because that's exactly what it's going to take. And that's true. And boy, he said, now listen, he said, now when I hung up the phone, he said, listen, I'm for you. I said, Dwight, I'm not worried about anything. I really feel like I did what was right. I will try to correct my mistakes, and I'll try to correct the situation because I don't want to do the wrong things. I said, but Dwight, I'm not worried about it. He said, well, that's what it takes. But boy, it comes hot and heavy. You can ask Max. He can tell you story after story after story how people have jumped on him about something. Yeah, it happens all the time.